and welcome to Counsel for the State. I'm Attorney General Lawrence Wasdin. Counsel for the State is a podcast produced by my office. Our goal in each episode is to share information with Idaho residents, journalists, and anyone with an interest in state government. Our aim is to increase transparency, further understanding of the office's role in government, and discuss timely legal topics. I hope you enjoy this installment and consider exploring past episodes as well. With that, here is the Office of the Attorney General, Public Information Officer, and Counsel for the State host, Scott Graff.
Hello and welcome to Counsel for the State. November's arrival means Idahoans are now entering their ninth month of dealing with the effects of COVID-19. The virus, which has spiked again in recent weeks, continues to affect nearly all aspects of our everyday lives. Our jobs, our schools, even our social activities, even things once as mundane as where and how we shop for our groceries, have changed for many. Among those reacting to the virus are the policymakers in our state who are attempting to protect public health. Like a lot of jobs these days, doing that is not a simple task. Those who serve on city councils, county commissions, school boards, public health districts, all the way up to the governor's office, continue to wrestle with decisions that balance the protection of public health with things like personal freedom and responsibility. These decisions have sometimes led to questions as to who has the authority to do what, and where do those authorities come from? We'll take a look at the answers to those questions on today's podcast. We'll also spend some time addressing some questions around open meeting requirements in Idaho, as they at times have changed during the pandemic. Joining me for today's discussion is Brian Kane, the Office of the Attorney General's Assistant Chief Deputy. Brian, of course, is also co-host of Counsel for the State. Brian, thanks again for being here.
Thanks, Scott. And I think since we're discussing all things COVID today, it's worth pointing out that we're recording this on Election Day during the pandemic, and we've seen a fairly significant shift in how the election is being handled, with record numbers of early voters in order to avoid essentially the in-person aspect of it and all that comes with it.
Absolutely. So just, Brian, I will start, not necessarily about the law and about government, but just out of curiosity, after 8 months, how are you doing?
So I think the thing that is probably the most interesting to me is the amount that we have learned during the pandemic. And the learning goes on, you know, a number of levels, right? Like, part of it is this, the pandemic has caused us all to kind of evaluate how we do our jobs and can we be effective, and what the necessity of in-person meetings, for example, is, and what do you miss when you don't have an in-person meeting. I think that it also, you know, we've all kind of taken stock of our houses and what it's like when you spend a lot of time in your house. Do you need another TV, or is that couch gotten too old? And so I think that, you know, on every level, it's caused an evaluation of how we live our lives and whether we're, you know, whether we're getting the most that we can out of those lives that we're living. Not to mention, you know, how we function as a society under these types of conditions, right? This is something none of us has ever faced before within our lifetime, and who knows what will happen in the future. But having lived through it once, I'm sure that, you know, there's a number of lessons that we'll carry forward.
One of the things that we discuss here on Counsel for the State on a regular basis, Brian, is your work with the legislature. You're the office's liaison to work with state lawmakers, one of the many clients the office has. You're central also to many other operations in the Office of the Attorney General, too. Based on your vantage point in state government, how would you say the state has changed from a governance perspective during the pandemic?
So I think that, you know, from my vantage point, the thing that has really emerged is that the state has been able to maintain governance and maintain its ability to meet the needs of its citizens without really missing a beat, even though we've had to do so virtually or from home or in these hybrid fashions where, you know, you work a day or two at home and then a day or two within the office. And I think that's the real... that's the real key here, is that, you know, as the pandemic strikes, right, government has still been able to do all of the things necessary for government to continue to function.
Has there been anything that has been diminished to a point of detriment?
So as far as services provided and the ability of government to meet the needs of its citizens, you know, I think that as citizens, they should have a lot of confidence, particularly in the Idaho government and state and local governments within Idaho, at their ability to adjust to and address the pandemic, but address the pandemic and continue to provide the vital services that citizens need throughout the pandemic. And so I haven't seen any drop off anywhere. I mean, it may take a little bit longer at times to get a specific service or something, but in terms of being responsive and being able to meet the needs of its citizens, right? Idaho government, both at the state and local level, I don't think has missed a beat.
And that leads into maybe the highest profile role that both local and state governments have taken on during the pandemic, and that has been one of protector of public health. And initially, much of the response during the pandemic, and I mean, you know, March and April, came from the governor, the Department of Health and Welfare. But after some time, the response then shifted to a more local one. The regional public health districts kind of stepped up and took the reins at one point over the summer. Then all the while, cities and counties have made their own rules too. One takeaway, I guess, for me has been that during times of a public health crisis, there are a lot of different entities in the state of Idaho who have the authority to make policy. And I recognize that's not necessarily a question, but more of a comment. But your reaction to that?
I think that's absolutely accurate, right? And I think that, you know, if I were to describe Idaho's system to address public health, it is a system of concurrent and overlapping authority. And it's a system that is entirely consistent with kind of the foundational element of checks and balances throughout our government, right? Because if one entity perhaps lacks the political will or the knowledge to enact a measure, there's another layer of government that still has that authority. And so they can check and balance one another as well as reinforce one another, right? And we're kind of seeing that currently, right? The governor has issued a statewide order, and within that statewide order, it specifically allocates the authority for local entities to adopt more stringent measures, right? And so if they've got a breakout in a smaller city that they're saying, hey, we've got to take a more stringent measure, the latitude is there. And it's a coexisting, coextensive type of authority within those specific jurisdictions.
We're discussing the law regarding, you know, the ability to make public policy in order to protect public health. Is it unusual to have virtually every layer of government owning some of the same authorities when it comes to, you know, fixing a specific problem?
I don't think so. I mean, if we zoom out and think about, you know, kind of the basic functions of government, right? One of the very first transactional functions of government was the protection of its citizens, right? And so if we go all the way back to Athens or Rome, or even into the feudal times, right? One of the first transactions was, hey, if you give us like a part of your crops, we will then protect you from invaders, right? You can come inside the castle walls and shelter, and we'll have an army that protects you from invaders. And I think that, you know, to me, that's the core of all of these laws, right? The foundational element of government is a protection of the public. And so when you see these, it makes sense then that at the state level, there would be authority, and then at the county level and the city level, and then regionally within these health districts, each layer of that government has that authority to protect public health.
Where do these authorities come from? You know, if you're a city councilor in, you know, a city in Idaho, or a county commissioner, state lawmaker, the governor, where are you looking to see what authorities you are prescribed in a situation like the COVID-19 response?
So the primary authority is the Constitution, right? And whenever we talk about authority, the first spot we should always look is our own Idaho Constitution. And so when you look at our Constitution, right, the governor derives his authority from Article 4, which outlines the executive department. And he's got that authority in Article 4, Section 5, which is titled Supreme Executive Power Vested in the Governor. And then if you think in terms of city or counties, those sorts of levels of government, it's Article 12, Section 2, which is local police regulations authorized. And that provision, you know, says that any county or city can make and enforce within its limits all local police, sanitary, and other regulations as they're not in conflict with its charter or the general laws. And so that's that, again, very most kind of basic foundational element of government being found in the Constitution. And then from the Constitution, you move forward into the statutes, and the statutes outline a series of different spots where the governor has authority, the cities have authority, public health districts have authority, and they've all got their own chapters, and the director of the Department of Health and Welfare has authority. And so they all kind of have this authority to address at the government at the appropriate level for whatever the situation is that's occurring.
And there's been some pushback at times over the last 8 months on various policies at the local level, all the way up to the state level. The statutes remind us how our laws get changed in Idaho, and then also remind us how our Constitution gets changed. If this has exposed something in our laws and our Constitution that enough people are less than thrilled with, based on how things have played out, how would they go about making the changes down the line so that next time things would look more like they want them to?
Sure. So statutorily, the legislature would be the one that changes those laws, the statutes, the things that you would find in like Title 50 or Title 39 or Title 56 or even Title 46, which are all various repositories in the code for emergency authority, depending on the level of government. If it's a constitutional amendment, then that would require two-thirds approval of both chambers of the legislature and then a vote by the majority of Idaho citizens. And so that would be on the ballot for all of us to vote on whether or not to change our Constitution in that fashion.
Okay. And this has also been sort of an interesting reminder that, you know, that there are at times laws that are passed or you know, measures, executive orders, whatever, on a state level. But then you've got county level issues, you've got, you know, city steps that the various cities have taken, and they all kind of interact with each other. An instance is that perhaps, you know, they vary. You know, maybe it's a lighter approach at the state level, but on the very local level, a city has taken a more stringent step. This is a situation where we can have local laws, ordinances that are more strict than those up the food chain, if you will, in terms of the governance structure, correct?
Absolutely. Yeah. And I mean, it makes sense, right? Idaho is a state with, you know, probably, I think we're somewhere in the neighborhood of 1.7 million people living here. We geographically, we occupy a massive piece of land geographically. And so, you know, what's happening in the city of Boise may not be the same phenomenon that's being experienced in Stanley, Idaho, or Idaho Falls, or Sandpoint, Idaho. And so the ability for those local entities to more specifically address exactly what's happening within their localities is essential to emergency and public health management.
One thing I'm always interested in is understanding the history of why things are the way they are. And I wonder, Brian, if you have any perspective on the history of some of these public health statutes in Idaho law, when they were passed, what brought them on, and so forth. Do you have any insight there?
Yeah, so a lot of these, so it's interesting because if you really drill down into these emergency laws, the laws don't really contemplate very deeply a pandemic such as what we're experiencing. The laws are actually set up for different types of emergency occurrences. And it's like the pandemic element was like, yeah, this might happen, but legislatively, this isn't our top priority, if that makes sense. Really, what they were thinking about are these other things. And so a good example of that is there's a provision in the Constitution in Article 3, Section 27 about continuity of government operations. And that provision came into being. It was adopted in 1960. And so if you know your history, you know that in 1957, Russia tested its first intercontinental ballistic missile, ICBM. Well, out of that, nobody believed them. It's actually a very funny historical story, right? The U.S. was like, hey, they've claimed this test. We don't really believe them. Well, what occurred after that was about 2 months after they tested this missile, they all of a sudden launched Sputnik. And that sent everyone scrambling because now for the first time ever, right, this demonstrated the ability of Soviet Russia to launch a missile that could land anywhere in the continental United States, actually beyond the continental, anywhere in the United States. And so folks kind of reacted to that. And so this continuity of operations statute, you can see, comes directly out of that. And when you read, and it's a great illustration of how these statutes are set up for something other than the pandemic, right? Because if you read the continuity of operations, right, it is anticipating some sort of like missile strike or bombing hitting like the state house and wiping out like half the legislature or something to that effect. And when you go back through these other emergency provisions, right, you'll see that there's a series of amendments in the 70s and 80s, which is in the wake of the Teton Dam collapse. And then you'll see another series of amendments and adjustments after September 11th. And so really what emerges from all of these amendments and the way that they've addressed these statutes is, you know, the disaster side of these or the attack side of these statutes is very firm with regard to authority and what can happen and all of those things. What isn't as firm and a little bit more iffy is this pandemic side. And I think that part of what you're seeing statewide is the fact that, like, if we have a dam collapse or if a missile blew up the Capitol building, right, you can physically see that damage. With something like a virus that's spreading from person to person, it's so unknown and nebulous, right? We don't know who has it. We don't know who's spreading it. We don't know if we've caught it. And that becomes a lot more difficult for folks to kind of put their arms around just on a very basic human level. And so I think that part of it is seeing the struggle as people try to deal with the difference between kind of a tangible dam collapse sort of scenario or a flood versus this less tangible, you know, the virus is out there and you could be subject to it. And the statutes, in my mind, also clearly recognize that distinction. And, you know, one of the things that we're probably going to see out of this is how we address pandemics in the future. And I know that a lot of folks are thinking, oh, the legislature is going to come in and adjust these statutes. But if we're thinking about it in terms of legal effect and what's going to work, it may be the sort of thing that the legislature actually wants to study and say, okay, this is what happened. What are the best ways to address this? How is it best that we should either amend our statutes or propose amending the Constitution?
I think that will be fascinating to watch. I think Idaho and many other states are dealing with a situation that wasn't necessarily accounted for in their state laws, and that there will be a period of adjustment here. And perhaps it's not, you know, in 2021, but maybe in the next 3 or 4 years for the next time to hopefully use what we've learned and tweak. And that's really, really fascinating perspective to think that we're dealing with a global pandemic here in our state with laws that were, you know, created in response to potential Cold War global situations. And then even something as specific as a dam collapse in the eastern part of the state. So another observation, Brian, that I've had during the pandemic is that there's been some very, very vocal critics of some of the policies implemented across the state. But considering how vocal some of the critics have been, I feel like as sort of just an observer of the news, there's actually been very little litigation that has resulted. As an attorney who understands all of these authorities, codes, case law, et cetera, why do you think that discrepancy exists?
I think that so it's interesting because there are some states where there's been a sizable amount of litigation. And yesterday I was kind of looking at a site that catalogs all of the pandemic litigation. And there are some states that have been very active within this sphere. But I think that part of it is that Idaho has really been very discreet. The governor has been very discreet with regard to the exercise of his emergency authority, as have local entities. And then on top of that, you know, I think that both at the state level and the local level, the emphasis has been on compliance as opposed to punishment. And so those two things working together kind of make it tough for somebody to really start challenging it through litigation, because one of the things that you've got to do in litigation is you got to say, hey, I've got this right. It's been trampled on by the government and I need redress. And so as discreet and kind of reserved as these exercises of authority have been, I don't know that it's that easy to get over the hurdle of my rights have been trampled and I need redress, if that makes sense.
Does it have anything to do perhaps with the breadth of these laws and the authority being clearly defined?
So I think, I mean, yes, I think that's absolutely part of it, right? And I mean, the law of quarantine within the United States is very old and very well established.
Right, let's shift gears. We have discussed at times the open meeting law, and the open meeting law is one of the things that changed at the state level in regards to how meetings could be conducted during the early portion of the pandemic. Let's start our conversation on this part of the pandemic response by talking about what changed back in the springtime.
Yeah, so in the springtime, what changed was the governor suspended Idaho Code Section 74-203, Paragraph 5. And what that paragraph does is it allows for entities to have telecommunication meetings. The statute is a little dated because now we would recognize those as kind of virtual or Zoom meetings. But this was adopted back at a time when teleconferences were the way that we could have a meeting. And these video conferencing capabilities weren't really present at that time, or they were very expensive and beyond kind of the reach of ordinary government. But part of that is to avoid having scenarios where folks would like walk into an empty room with just a speaker box, you know, on the floor or on the wall. The provision includes a section that requires participation by a member of the governing body or a director of the agency or their chief administrative officer has to be in a room with wherever this telecommunications device is so that folks don't walk into that empty room, or as I like to think about it, you know, the set of like a science fiction movie or something. And so I think that provision was suspended that enabled entities to have entirely virtual meetings. And so you could have a meeting that was conducted completely on Zoom or completely by teleconference, as long as you provided the public with the means to observe and hear the meeting.
Okay. And that was done by executive order, and that executive order had a date of expiration on it, essentially, or it lasted only for a certain amount of time. What is the situation regarding that aspect of the open meeting law at this point?
So the executive order allowing for all virtual meetings expired June 27th at midnight. And so since then, everyone should be having meetings that allow for folks to have a physical location of the meeting.
But there are still a lot of meetings that have an online, a Zoom component to them.
Right.
But that's not required by law, correct?
It's not required by law. I think that, you know, folks are doing that more as a way to kind of keep everyone safe and adequately address the pandemic requirements and social distancing and mask wearing and all of those sorts of things. And we're seeing, you know, local entities that are having like capacity limits on their meeting, right? We're going to have a meeting at City Hall, but we've only got room for 10 attendees. And therefore, since we've got that limited capacity, we're also going to make sure that the meeting is available to observe online or something.
I wonder if this is one of those things that will potentially be a lasting effect of the pandemic, that local government entities, state government entities that have to abide by the open meeting law have figured out, you know, technologically, this maybe isn't that big of a deal to have an online component. And thus, you know, their transparency level can increase if folks can log on at their kitchen counter during the workday, or their desk at the office, or whatever that may be. Do you think that has some legs potentially once, knock on wood, hopefully the pandemic comes to an end, that this is something that we might see as an outgrowth long term?
I think it's a really interesting question. And I think that it's interesting because there's two sides to it, right? There's the side of, hey, this is really efficient for us as an entity to be able to conduct our business this way. And we don't have to come down and all meet together, and we can kind of, you know, have our meeting wherever we want to be. But there's a flip side to that, right? And the flip side to that is, does the virtual meeting space create too much detachment from the governing body and the constituents that it governs? And I've heard this described by some folks who are unhappy with the virtual meetings as saying, you know, we want to be able to see the whites of the eyes of the folks making the decisions. And I think that, you know, to me, that's the heart of this debate, right? Yes, virtual meetings create efficiencies and they create the ability to meet remotely in continuity of operations. But there's also a governmental responsiveness element that I think we need to make sure is being maintained, or at least it's debatable that we need to make sure is maintained. And so I'm not sure that you're going to see a movement like in this legislative session to say, hey, let's make all meetings virtual. And I think that because of the importance of that debate, right, the connectivity between the governed and the governors.
Yeah, and I think that's a very fair point. I guess this is probably Scott, the ex-reporter, who, you know, is obviously interested in accessibility and that sort of thing. But I wonder if, you know, there's, for instance, some city governments across the state who have figured out that they've been forced into a situation via the pandemic to figure out how to make the technology work. And that while there still has to be the online, or I'm sorry, the in-person component now, maybe going forward, they go, you know, this was a nice service we provided to our constituents. Perhaps we will, you know, we still have to abide by the open meeting law as it exists today. But maybe we go ahead and offer the Zoom component as well. And that's potentially a lingering effect where, you know, you might have 12 people that show up for the every other week city council meeting if it's in person. But if it's online, you might have 60 or 70 people tuning in on a Monday or Tuesday evening to see what is going on in their city government.
Yeah, and I think that's a great observation. I think that, you know, one of the things that governments maybe learn from this is, you know, number one, hybrid meetings as they are, right, where you have both the in-person component, but then also the telecommunication or Zoom or whatever, the virtual component. And does that increase their transparency, and does that increase the engagement from citizens because they can kind of watch it, you know, or listen in as they're making dinner or whatever it is that they've got going on in their lives where they wouldn't be able to set that much time away and go down and physically sit in the room. And so I think that's a huge opportunity for local governments. I think the other thing that I've seen occur out of this, and it'll be interesting to see if this continues, is I've seen a number of governmental entities kind of create YouTube channels or Facebook pages that then hold recordings of the meetings. And so they've got the virtual meeting recorded where you can just pull it up at any point and watch the meeting. And maybe, you know, if you're really into government, you know, you could set a Saturday aside and binge watch all the city council meetings like you would, you know, Desperate Housewives or something. But I think that, you know, to me, that's one of those interesting evolutions that could come out of this, right? Are government entities going to embrace this ability to record and post meetings and almost create their own kind of government channels within these spaces? And again, you know, if you think about it from your reporter hat, that's helpful to you because it gives you the ability to access many meetings when previously you would have to pick and choose which meetings you went to because you can only be in one place at one time. And so I think that those are some of the things that are out there as potential, you know, improvements.
Absolutely. So shifting gears, looking ahead as we wrap up this Council for the State episode, it's been 8 months. Are there other aspects of state government that you expect to be affected by COVID that maybe we haven't really seen or thought a whole lot about? You know, one of my specific questions, obviously, you know, we're 2 months away from the legislative session, the annual session scheduled to start in the beginning of January. 2 months ago was the beginning of September. That's not a lot of time. It's going to be here before we know it. That or other aspects of government that may be changing?
So I feel like at this point in time, you know, government has changed the way that it's going to change. Legislatively, it's really difficult to predict that, although if the special session is an indicator, it's going to be that, you know, legislatively, it's probably going to be a little bit more business as usual than adjusting. Although the one thing that I think will be interesting to keep an eye on is if the legislature allows for more remote testimony within committees, for example. And again, you know, you've got some folks that are mindful of social distancing and capacity limits within those committee rooms. And one of the ways to address that is to allow for more remote access to those meetings. Right now, all of those meetings are streamed. And so you can listen in from wherever you are, but you don't necessarily have the ability to provide testimony remotely. And whether the legislature is going to take a hard look at that and say, hey, we want to make sure that this is, we want to make sure that folks have access to testify remotely on our committee legislation. So I think that's something to really keep an eye on. And I think the other thing to keep an eye on is how the legislature reacts to all of the authority that's been exercised thus far. And I look at that in two ways. Number one, is it the sort of thing that the legislature is going to come right into town and say, hey, these are the things we need to fix? Or is it going to be the sort of thing that the legislature comes into town and takes a more measured approach and says, you know what? We went through a lot, and I don't think we want to react right away. I think we want to give some time to kind of study it and have more backward-looking, reflective legislation on what the authority is and how it should be exercised. And I think those will be really interesting things to kind of take a look at.
Brian, any final thoughts?
You know, I think that, you know, this pandemic has taught us a number of lessons. I think it has also kind of reinforced the importance of human connection within our everyday lives. And so I think that, you know, if you've got a friend or someone that's out there and you haven't talked to in a while, it's worth reaching out to them and saying a hello. And I think it's also one of those things where it calls on us to be a little bit more patient with one another and maybe a little bit more patient with government as it works through those problems. And finally, since it's Election Day, please stay involved and, you know, vote today, of course. And if you voted earlier, that's great. But once you vote, your work as a citizen isn't done, right? It's incumbent to stay aware and stay up to date and stay involved.
Brian, really interesting conversation. I appreciate your insights and expertise. And glad you're to hear that you're hanging in there after 8 months. And who knows if we've got 8 more months of what we've been through ahead of us. Obviously, we hope not, but continue hanging in there. And thanks, of course, to everyone who's been listening to Council for the State. And we hope you're hanging in there as well. So with that, we'll wrap up this episode. A reminder that each Council for the State podcast is available through iTunes and Spotify. If you know someone who would like to listen and they're not necessarily fully understanding of how to be a podcast subscriber, that's okay. They can just stream each episode from the Attorney General's website. Every episode is archived at ag.idaho.gov. Thank you again for being with us.